From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Ellen DeGeneres came out in 1997, she went straight from the closet to the cover of Time magazine, not to mention being all over the tabloids. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about how she came out, how her sitcom character Ellen came out too, and how everything changed. DeGeneres is about to start a national tour of her stand-up comedy show. Also today, we talk with Andy Richter. He was Conan O'Brien's late-night sidekick for 7 years. Now he's starring in the Fox TV sitcom Andy Richter Controls the Universe. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by drummer Ed Thigpen featuring saxophonist Joe Lovano. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says his forces will be out of most West Bank cities within a week. Sharon told CNN that he includes Jenin in that timetable, but not Bethlehem or Ramallah. Palestinians dismissed Sharon's comments. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
He said the troops and tanks would be gone inside a week. It was a far cry from the immediate pullout demanded some time ago by President George Bush and the United Nations Security Council, but it was the first time Sharon has offered even a tentative deadline for a pullout. In Bethlehem, where a standoff continues around the Church of the Nativity, the one-week deadline will not apply. And that also goes for Ramallah, where the enforced isolation of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat will continue. Palestinian negotiator Sy Barakat dismissed Sharon's withdrawal pledge, saying Sharon has said the troops would only withdraw to security zones, maintaining the closures in the West Bank. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Thousands of demonstrators gathered at the Capitol today to express support for Israel. The demonstrators cheered former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he called Palestinian leader Arafat the quintessential terrorist. Some booed when Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said that both Palestinians and Israelis must make hard choices to achieve a lasting peace. At least 4 American soldiers were killed in Afghanistan today when an old rocket exploded while they were trying to destroy it. The blast hurt at least one other soldier. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from the Pentagon.
Clearing minefields and destroying old, unexploded ordnance is dangerous work in Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the latest incident shows that servicemen and women in Afghanistan continue to put their lives on the line every day, fighting or no fighting.
In this instance, it was a disposal unit that was actively working to destroy some weapons that had been found, and for whatever reason, one of them went off.
A defense official says the weapon that exploded was a 107-millimeter rocket, a good-sized missile whose detonation would be a major explosion. Circumstances of the accident remain unclear. This is only the latest fatal accident during efforts to dispose of unexploded ordnance. 3 German and 2 Danish peacekeepers died last month when a missile they were trying to destroy exploded while they were working on it. Tom Jelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
The Vatican says Pope John Paul will meet with Roman Catholic cardinals from the United States next week to discuss the American Church's handling of allegations of sexual abuse by priests. The meeting will include 8 American cardinals and 2 leaders of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 97 points to close at 10,093 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 2 points. It closed at 1,753. The S&P 500 lost 8 to close at 1,102. This is NPR News. U.S. officials say a videotape showing Osama bin Laden and one of his top aides doesn't seem to provide evidence that the terrorist leader is still alive. The tape was shown on the Arab network Al Jazeera today. It included shots of bin Laden and his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, as well as some footage of a man identified as one of the September 11th hijackers. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said he saw what might have been the same tape over the weekend, but that it appeared to be old footage. Former Supreme Court Justice Byron White has died. He was 84. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Only 8 men served longer on the Supreme Court than Byron White, but even his biography spends more time describing his non-judicial career, largely because his life off the court was such a fascinating tale. from his modest beginnings in Colorado on the family beet farm to his heroic deeds in World War II and his brilliant academic and athletic career, White was a star, so brilliant that in the space of just a few years, he won a Rhodes Scholarship and was also the leading rusher for the NFL. By 1961, he was Deputy Attorney General and went to Alabama as the Kennedy administration's point man charged with protecting the Freedom Riders. Soon after, President Kennedy appointed him to the Supreme Court, where, as one scholar put it, the traits that marked his intellectual and writing style were the same ones that served him well on a football field and on a burning aircraft carrier. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Kenyan runners captured the top four places in the Boston Marathon today. First place went to Rogers Ropp. Kenyan women took the top two places in the women's race, with Margaret Okayo breaking the course record for women. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the New York Times, featuring a new Friday section called Escapes, covering topics ranging from weekend destinations to cars to real estate. Expect the world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ellen DeGeneres made history when she played the first openly gay leading character in a TV series. When the character Ellen Morgan came out in the fourth season of the sitcom Ellen, DeGeneres came out too. That year, 1997, the show won a Peabody Award, but the ratings went down after Ellen came out and the show was canceled the following year. Last fall, DeGeneres returned to TV with a CBS sitcom called The Ellen Show about a gay woman who returns to her small hometown after her dot-com company goes broke. DeGeneres doesn't expect the series to return next fall, and if it doesn't, she expects to host a new talk variety show that will premiere in the fall of 2003. Ellen DeGeneres first became known as a stand-up comic. She's about to begin a national tour of her new stand-up act. 2 years ago, she did a comedy tour that was taped for HBO. Although she was out, most of her act had nothing to do with sexual orientation, but she did have something to say about it.
Very interesting. We have this huge debate going on right now about same-sex marriage. There are people who are against it. There are people who are for it. And the people who are against it, some people say marriage is a union between a man and a woman, and it's always been that way, and it should always remain that way. If we change it and it's between two people of the same sex, then what's next? Someone could marry an animal. That's where they go to right away. These people scare me, and they think we're weird. Right? I don't want to marry a goat. I really don't. I can't imagine marrying a goat. I can't even imagine dating a goat. Getting to the point that you're that serious to make that kind of commitment. That clear you'd live together for a little while to figure it out and see if you're compatible, but I would think that would be a tough day, even for the most liberal parents, the day you bring the goat home. Yes. Mom? Dad? This is Billy? We are in love.
Ellen DeGeneres, welcome back to Fresh Air. How does it feel to be doing stand-up again?
It's a mixture for me. I mean, I love it when I'm on stage, but this part right now, before I start, I'm driving myself crazy because I have found everything in the world to do other than sit down and write. I bought a car. I landscaped my backyard. Every drawer in the house is organized. I hate sitting down and writing, so I'm kind of down to the wire, and I'm still really nervous. But then once I'm on stage, I'm fine.
Right. Now, here's something I used to wonder about. When you were doing stand-up before you came out, I wondered if there was material that you would have included in your performances, but that you didn't include because you weren't out. So it was the kind of observation you couldn't really talk about. So this is a double question. I'm wondering if that was the case then, and if you're including more of that type of observation now.
No, nothing's changed, and I think that was my huge concern when I did this last tour, the beginning, 2 years ago for my HBO special. I thought I'm probably going to have, just about an entire audience of homosexuals instead of what I used to have, which was a lot of homosexuals, but it was a mix. It was a lot of everybody, because my humor was always just basic. It wasn't even female humor necessarily. It was just observations and weird stories and There was nothing that I thought, oh, if I was only out, I could talk about, you know, how girls are together. Or if I just never, you know, was going to do that anyway, and I still don't do it. None of my humor has changed, and I mean, I think anybody who saw the beginning, there's really nothing that's, except for being honest about the fact that I'm gay, nothing really has changed as far as what I find funny.
Do you feel in a way pulled in two different directions at once? On the one hand, being like, gay role model, and on the other hand, not wanting to make a big deal about it?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm not a political person, I'm not an activist, and I kind of got sucked into that role just, you know, by being honest about, you know, my sexuality. I didn't do it for any other reason other than I got tired of, in interviews, having to dodge around that question, and it wasn't something that I felt like hiding anymore or feeling ashamed of. And I really didn't even think I was ashamed of it, but I thought, well, how can I not be ashamed of it? If I can't, you know, just come out and say it, there's got to be some shame attached to it. So, yeah, it's really hard. And I don't think that I'm a gay role model either. I think that I'm a gay person, and there are a lot of different types of gay people. I mean, there are a lot of different, you know, types. I don't know who the straight role model would be. You know, I think that everybody's different, and I certainly don't represent every gay person. I just represent me, and if other people feel that. But I think visibility is important. I think representation is important for everyone, and it's got nothing to do with sexuality. It's just someone else to relate to. And so I think it's important, but I certainly don't think I'm a role model.
When you got your first TV show, did the writers, did the producers, did the network executives know that you were gay?
Yeah, everybody knew. When I was offered, I was doing a show called Laurie Hill for Neil Marlins, who created my first show, Ellen. I was joking with him. I said, if this show doesn't go, will you create a show for me? And because I had, like, you know, two lines in it every show. I had nothing. I was, you know, I mean, I think one show I said hello. And he said that he would. And sure enough, the show got canceled. And he called me and he said, we want to create a show for you. And I couldn't believe he was, you know, really doing it. And I said, you know, I just want to let you know, because you may change your mind and you may not want to take a chance on this, but I'm gay. And he kind of laughed and he said, yeah, we know you're gay. And he said, do you want to be gay on the show? And I said, no, I don't want to be gay on the show. And he said, okay. But he said, we know you're gay. And then and then the show was developed, and then the tabloids immediately started printing things about me being in bars and me doing this and that, and it was, and none of it was true. And I had been really, I usually don't go out anyway. I occasionally go out, but I'm pretty much a boring, stay-at-home person. But I went to the, you know, president of ABC, and I said, the stuff in the tabloids isn't true, and I don't go to bars, and I don't. And he said, you know, we don't care about that stuff. And, you know, it was all new to me, so I thought he was going to fire me immediately because I was seen in a gay bar.
So how did you decide that you wanted, you know, you wanted to come out at the same time that your character did, that that would happen simultaneously?
Well, I thought it'd be really embarrassing if my character came out and I didn't. I thought that would be really tough. Why'd you have to go and do that? Now I've got to come out. I don't know. I was just going to do it for me. And then I thought, you know, what's the big deal if I do it? And the show is kind of floundering and struggling to find its identity. And I just, you know, it seemed like the character was gay anyway, because I never dated on the show, and it was always just, you know, this, every other show, any single woman, the whole show is about finding the right guy. And I just thought it would be interesting. And we just thought we'd do it at the same time. And I think we found some really interesting, you know, areas and areas that nobody had ever gone into on television. I'm really proud of that last season. I thought it was great.
What were the script writing sessions like for the coming out episode, in which, you know, you and the writers tried to figure out, I assume you were in on those sessions, tried to figure out what the right storyline would be?
Yeah, it's all kind of a blur to me. I used to write every single night. Once we got the go-ahead, we really didn't have much time because Disney didn't let us know until the last minute. They knew all season long because we were trying to build up slowly and do clues, and we really didn't want it to leak out. We just thought we would have the audience watching from the beginning of the season, and these little clues would happen, and they would be like, are they doing what I think they're doing? That's what we wanted to happen, and then it just be the episode where I came out. But unfortunately, it leaked out, and then we still didn't have the go-ahead from Disney, even after it leaked out. I wrote a lot by myself at night at home, and then I think we had one script that went in, and then it wasn't right, and then we got together and all did it again, and it was fantastic, and then we all won an Emmy for it. It was very exciting.
Can you give me an idea of a script line that you threw out that you thought, this isn't right, this isn't the way to do it?
I don't know. We just we kind of came up with the right storyline with the ex-boyfriend coming in town and this guy that I was just crazy about and seeing him again. And that would be the tip-off that it just something was missing. But we wanted to make it where the character really was completely in denial. You know, she just didn't know she was gay until she met someone else who was gay, and it threatened her even more. But I really don't remember the first, it's 5 years ago, actually, 5 years ago this month.
And then there was the question of how to handle the first kiss.
Yeah.
Which was part of the script line.
But that wasn't on the coming out episode.
Was that later?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we couldn't kiss. No, that... I mean, the coming out episode was just basically me saying, you know, that I was gay. But the first kiss was the next season, and it was a huge, huge thing. I mean, it was a problem, you know, and there was a advisory label and, you know, all that.
What did the advisory label say?
I don't know. It was shocking to me because I didn't know. I was just at home watching the show one night, and all of a sudden, you know, it was almost like there was some kind of nuclear war happening. It was just, you know, caution, the contents of this show, or, you know, it was just like this. The first time it happened, it was because we were holding hands. We held hands. And because I was looking for what it was. I mean, there are these shows like on Right Before Me and Right After Me where people that aren't married are having sex. And there's a, you know, sexual, you know, connotation to every single thing out of everyone's mouth. And, you know, that's okay. It's okay for, you know, people with kids to watch, you know, people having sex and no matter how old you are and everything being. But you can't hold hands. That was just so shocking to me.
My guest is Ellen DeGeneres. She's about to begin a national tour of her new comedy act. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ellen DeGeneres is my guest, and she's about to start a national tour of her show, Ellen DeGeneres in Concert. You really went from one extreme to the other when you came out, because you'd been in the closet. And then when you came out, not only you came out, but your character, Ellen, came out. And you were on the cover of Time magazine, and to top it off, you were having a very public relationship with Anne Heche at this time. What was it like to go from one extreme to the other almost overnight?
It was weird. I mean, my life is just, you know, I really went from, I was just thrilled that I had a career. I mean, it started as a stand-up and worked, you know, from playing little places that held 150 people. And, you know, there were really just about 50 people in there and or 40 weren't conscious because they were drunk. It was just, I mean, I really went through working my way up to get to a place where I actually got a television show. And I was so thrilled that I had a television show, and I was so thrilled that I had made it so far from New Orleans to be, you know, have a successful television show that, you know, it just, you know, to come out was just kind of a thing that I just felt like I had to do. I really didn't realize what that would do to my career, to my my life, you know. It just, and like you said, you know, it was a very public time for me. And I think that, you know, if I could play my life as It's a Wonderful Life, and if I hadn't gotten involved and hadn't been in a relationship, I think it would be very, very different. I don't think it would have been so public. I think I just would have done the show and I would have kept doing the show. But I think that was a really wild time for me. I want to be really careful about this too, because I want to say that as I talk about this, I haven't talked about it, and I want to be careful how I word it, because I want to say I take full responsibility for being a participant. But at the same time, as I have perspective on it, I was in a very vulnerable place, coming from a very fearful place, and I met a very fearless person who enjoys attention. And I was influenced, and I was, like, you know, being told, what are you, crazy? You're going to be on the cover of Time magazine, and yet you're worried about, you know, going to a premiere and doing this and doing that. And I was like, yeah, you're right, you're right. And I just, you know, it's, and again, I take responsibility, but I think that my life was so huge and so public, and I was doing things because I felt like there was only the other extreme, you know. I wasn't paying attention to my gut feeling, which is, okay, I did this, and now let's just be quiet about it, and that's all I wanted to do. Because really, that was what my gut was.
So you think, but you both had basically different temperaments regarding the public nature of a relationship?
Absolutely. And I, you know, I mean, my relationship is obviously very different now. I have a very quiet relationship, and it will remain that way. And, you know, so I think that it all exploded at once. It was a big thing for me to come out. It was a big thing for the character to come out. It was a big thing for someone who, you know, had never, you know, who was, it was two, you know, famous people that, you know, it was and the world hadn't seen that. And it was a big thing when we showed up at a premiere or did anything. It was always, we lived out our life, you know, publicly, and as a result, I made a lot of very public mistakes, and I think now I've learned to follow my own instinct and not get influenced or be persuaded by other people, and just trust myself.
I mean, one of the real paradoxes is that the person who was leaning more toward the public part of the relationship and to, you know, big public statements and everything was somebody who had been straight up until that point.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, and that's the thing, if I would have met the person I'm with now or you know, any gay person would know the consequences, because we live our lives understanding the consequences all the time. Even if you're out, you know that there's a certain, you know, line to draw. And I think most straight people know that too. But, you know, this person did not and didn't care about rules or lines or anything. And so, you know, that's, you know, I don't know. It's all a kind of hard subject to talk about.
But no, I understand that.
But it's my life, and it's also a lot of, you know, I'm very proud of what I did, and I'm very proud of everything that came out of it as far as helping everyone. But there are a lot of things that I realize I turned a lot of people off, and I pay for that every day. And I'm, you know, just trying to get my life back to normal, my career back to normal. And so there's part of me that wants to talk about it just to explain and to say, you know, I understand that I rub people the wrong way. I understand that it was a lot of it seemed very in your face.
What's an example of something that you wish you hadn't done that you feel in retrospect wasn't really you?
It's hard to pick out one specific thing, but I think that it's just the fact that I got so upset by the networks shying away, or advertisers pulling, or everything, and I took it personally, and I think that was hard for me, and you know, I got upset with the press because I couldn't turn on the television without being, you know, the punchline of somebody's joke, or it was constant in magazines. I was a joke, or the relationship was a joke, and it all was too much for me. It really sent me into a downward spiral after I lost the show, especially because that was my entire life. I had been doing that show for 5 years, and I loved doing that show, and suddenly I lost it, and it's really hard when you're used to going to work every single day and, as a performer, used to that release, that outlet, And suddenly it's just shut off from you. And not only is it shut off, there's nobody else knocking on the door. And not only that, but every time you even open a magazine or think about turning on, you know, I mean, I was even scared to open House and Garden or Architectural Digest. I was like, am I going to be in here? I mean, it was just, it got to a point. I really thought, you know, I can't escape it, you know? I mean, the weirdest things would happen to me. Like, you know, I'd be stopped at a red light and this cop was next to me one day and said, hey, how you doing? And I said, okay. And he goes, I just saw, where did I see you? Some magazine. I said, I don't know. And he goes, yeah, some magazine. And I'm just like, please don't say anything. And it's like I'm waiting for the light to turn green. And all of a sudden he goes, anyway, they were making fun of your shirt. Have a nice day. And just pulls away. And I just thought, this is just cruel now. It's just plain cruel. He just thought that was, anyway, they were making fun of your shirt. Have a nice day. I was like, the light couldn't have turned green just 30 seconds earlier. He had to get that out. But it really was just, you know, a hard, hard time for me. And I just, you know, I just thought, you know, I just got hurt and angry and everything. And so...
Was there a period where you felt it's over, that period is over?
No, I felt like I kind of, I thought, okay, it had been... I guess a year or so, and I just, that's when I started writing the special, the beginning, when I just thought, this is ridiculous. Okay, I'm not getting offered any jobs. Nobody's calling, but I'm a writer. That's how I got here. I'm funny, and I'm a writer. I'm not funny right now because I'm extremely depressed, but something is still inside of me, and I can take control of this. And I thought, I need to write another stand-up special. I need to remind people of who I am and why I'm here. And I didn't just get lucky, and then I came out to make, you know, and that was hurtful too. The people thought I was coming out to get attention or to, you know, for ratings. It's like, you know, look at all the people lined up, you know, that were doing it before me and after me. That because it's such a great thing for your career. So I just thought I'll write a special, and then I was just thinking, well, what if no straight people ever like me again? I'm just going to be like, you know, this gay icon, and I'm not going to write gay material. Then the gay people are going to come see me and go, that's not gay material. She's not being gay enough. So I just thought, I'm just going to write a special, and hopefully once it airs, people will see that I'm the same person. It's, you know, all I ever wanted to do was, you know, be a funny person.
Ellen DeGeneres is about to begin a national tour of her new stand-up comedy act. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Yoga Gems, a treasury of practical and spiritual wisdom from ancient and modern masters, edited by George Feuerstein, Ph.D., and WGBH Boston, proudly presenting a story of globalization, Commanding Heights, the battle for the world economy, Wednesday night on PBS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Andy Richter talks about his new sitcom, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, and his years as Conan O'Brien's late-night sidekick. Also, Ellen DeGeneres tells us about watching her mother become a gay rights activist, and Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by drummer Ed Thigpen featuring saxophonist Joe Lovano. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ellen DeGeneres. She's about to begin a national tour of her new stand-up comedy act. In 1997, during the fourth season of her ABC sitcom Ellen, DeGeneres came out, and her character, Ellen Morgan, did too. DeGeneres made the cover of Time magazine. After you came out, your mother, Betty, became a gay rights activist. Was it really surprising to see her in that role? She looks like such a mild-mannered person, and she's been very effective in the role of a gay activist, as you know, as the mother of a lesbian telling other parents. Did this seem very out of character for her to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't even know who that person was. She... After she was on, you know, I did the interview with Diane Sawyer on Primetime, and my mother was on it. And after it aired, my mother said, you know, everybody is really responding to me. I'm thinking about getting a commercial agent. So I'm going to get headshots, and I'm going to do commercials. And I said, Mom, you really want to sell grape nuts? Is that what you want to do? Is that, I mean, I think that they're responding to you because of you, that you weren't playing a character and you weren't, you know, but she just wanted to do something, and she's, you know, and I said, why don't you do something that's actually going to make a difference? You know, that's what's going to feel good, is if you actually do something that you're helping. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, just call like the HRC, ask somebody if you can help. I'm sure if you say that, you know, I'm Ellen's mom and I'd like to do something, they're going to give you a job.
The HRC is Human Rights Campaign, which is a gay rights group.
Yes. And so she called Elizabeth Birch over there and said, I'm Ellen's mom, and I want to help. And they were like, hold on. You know, they just they couldn't even believe. So they started having her travel around, and she goes and speaks. You know, she's out there and helping a lot of people, which is so great because there are a lot of, you know, families that need some help.
How did you come out to her?
I just told her that, you know, I met some. We were always really close, and I always felt like I could tell her anything. And I told her that I was gay, and that which it was a shock to her because I had so many boyfriends all through high school, and you know, I was just boy crazy, and she just didn't understand it. She thought it was a phase, and she was fine. She was a little shocked, but she wasn't angry, and she didn't, you know, freak out or anything. And because there were no books and she didn't understand what to do with it, she went to the library and got some books and started trying to read about homosexuality and try to figure it out, which is great that she's written books now to help people, because there should be books to help parents when they find that out. But she was great.
Were you surprised that she was great, or did you expect her to be great?
I expected her to be great. My mom's, you know, I mean, she and I have been through a lot together, and when my mom and dad divorced, it was just my brother left. He was in a band, and they went touring, and it was just my mom and I from the time I was 13 on. And it's how I started doing comedy, because she went through a really hard time and dated some guys that were just some horrible, horrible men that treated her really badly. And she'd be crying sometimes, and I'd just start doing things to make her laugh, and she'd start laughing, and then I'd imitate her laughing, and then she would start laughing so hard she was crying, and then I would be laughing and crying with her. And I saw the power as a 13-year-old kid to take care of my mother, to change her mood, to make her happy when she was so unhappy. It was an amazing feeling, and I think that's the beginning of when I realized that I wanted to do that, because I could change people's moods and feelings. And I saw, you know, and I moved, you know, every 2 years we went, I went to a different school, so I had to start over everywhere. So I used humor to fit in everywhere I went. So,
In your stand-up act before you came out, you used to do a story that was based on a real story in your life, and it was the story of someone who you described, I think, as your roommate who died in a car crash, someone who you clearly cared really deeply about. You know, and in this set of stand-up comedy was this very moving, emotional moment. I assume that person was probably a lover, not just a roommate. Assuming that's true, was it ever difficult back then to tell that story and invest all this emotional weight in it and not be able to really tell why you were so emotional?
No, I did. It was actually, I wrote The Phone Call to God. Her name was Kat. She was my girlfriend, and we were living together at the time, and she was killed in a car accident. And it was, I was 20 years old, and it was my first realization that, you know, how precious life is. I think it was a beautiful gift, actually, to me that I was able to learn that early on, to appreciate every single moment of life. Because you're never the same after you lose somebody that you love, and especially at that age, it just doesn't seem possible. And I actually saw the accident, and I didn't know it was her. I slowed down, and I could hear the sirens behind me, so they were just getting there, and I just kept going, and I didn't realize it was her until the next morning. And so I wrote this piece called The Phone Call to God, mm-hmm. because I went home and, just was obviously depressed and trying to figure things out. And there were fleas all over this place that I was staying in. And I just thought, why are fleas here? Here's this beautiful, amazing 21-year-old girl just gone, and fleas are here. And what if we could just pick up the phone and call up God and ask God these things? And I just started writing. I'd never written comedy before. And I put the pen to the paper, and I wrote out what it would be like. I imagined that you'd have to, hold the phone to your ear for a long time before God answers, because it's a huge place, so it would ring forever. And then I imagined finally saying, yeah, hi, God. Sure, I'll hold on. Realizing God's very busy, and then be put on hold and listen to Onward Christian Soldiers, because that would be the hold music. And then say it's Ellen DeGeneres, and then, God would make fun of my name. Sounds like degenerate. And then it would be this whole long thing about what it would be like to talk to God. And I finished writing. It just poured out of me. And I looked at it, and I thought, I'm going to do that on the Johnny Carson show. And I'm going to be the first woman ever to be called over to sit down on the first set, because no woman had ever been called over on the first time to sit down. That was the big thing for Johnny Carson, the motion to come sit down. And I was. I was the first and only woman in the history of the show to be called over because of The Phone Call to God. I did it. I think.
But that's the thing that's bizarre, because here you are talking about your lover.
Yeah.
And yet being totally closeted, but people like love what it is that you're saying about.
Sure. And it was a funny thing. They actually didn't know. When I was doing it on stage, I didn't say. I actually just said, I don't understand why certain things are here. But it was, I think by that time, because it was like 7 years later that I did The Tonight Show or something like that. It was hard also, because I didn't really get to grieve or acknowledge how devastating that was for me, mm-hmm. Because now, somebody loses their husband or their wife, and everybody's just, they know how hard it is. But when you lose your girlfriend, especially at 20 years old, it's just, oh, she's your friend, and that's a shame your friend died,
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ellen DeGeneres, I really appreciate you talking with us. I'm hoping that you'll be back on TV sometime soon with something or another.
Yeah. Well, I still haven't gotten the official word that they're not picking us up for next season. I assume we're not. But if I don't get picked up for CBS, there's something else very exciting I have as a backup that I can announce as soon as I find out. But we still don't know anything for sure.
Well, that's great. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
You too. Thanks.
Ellen DeGeneres is about to begin a national tour of her stand-up comedy show. Coming up, Andy Richter on his new sitcom and his years as Conan O'Brien's sidekick. This is Fresh Air. After 7 years as Conan O'Brien's sidekick, Andy Richter left Late Night in June of 2000 to act. Last month, he returned to TV as the star of his own sitcom, Andy Richter Controls the Universe. He plays a single guy who works at a corporation writing manuals. The action alternates between what's really happening and the fantasy version of events happening in his mind. In one episode, Andy falls for a beautiful woman and can't believe his good luck when he finds she's attracted to him. Everything's going great, until something she says makes him realize she's anti-Semitic. But he doesn't want to believe what he knows is true.
It could have been a lot of things. I needed more information, so I came up with a foolproof anti-Semitism test.
Would you like a bagel? Or perhaps a Waldenreichen Lebensraum Torte?
Oh, thanks.
She has chosen the time-honored food of the Jewish people. She's not a bigot.
Boy, those Jews are so cheap, they don't even give you the middle of the bagel.
Oi. Leslie, I gotta tell you, it bothers me when you say stuff like that.
Oh, my God. You're not Jewish, are you?
No, I just think it's wrong to stereotype people.
Oh, I see what's going on here. You must have some Jewish friends or something, and you feel self-conscious about it.
Wait a minute. This is not my problem.
Andy, let's not argue. We don't have to like the same books, the same music, the same races. Can't we just agree to disagree about this one thing?
No, people are just people.
And that's your opinion. All I'm asking is that you respect mine. Oh, look, we've just had our first fight. I'm glad it was over something small.
Andy Richter, who came up with that premise for this episode of meeting a woman who you're very attracted to, but the attraction only lasts so long because she's anti-Semitic?
It was just one of the ideas that came, you know, that was sort of gang-written by the writers on the show. I think that we as a group like things that are funny that are also kind of uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely uncomfortable to a lot of people. And I felt what I really like about that episode is that you see plenty of shows where somebody is dating somebody that they're mismatched with, but it's usually some sort of thing about, you know, oh, she snores or she, you know, has a goofy laugh. And I've never seen anyone, there be a lighthearted romp through someone's anti-Semitism. So I sort of felt like that it was, you know, that it was a funny idea and it was a different idea, and that, yeah, it's also uncomfortable and kind of, you know, naughty in a serious way. But, I don't think that it's unreal. I don't think that it's not true to life.
Were you confident when you left Late Night with Conan O'Brien that you would get movie roles and TV roles? Or did you feel like you were kind of jumping off the edge and hoping that you'd land?
A little bit of both. A lot more confidence than there was the fear of the leap of faith. But because I just kind of felt, in retrospect, I feel scared in retrospect because I feel like I wasn't even aware. I wasn't allowing myself to be aware of what a leap it was. But I just thought, I know enough about Hollywood to know that Hollywood really wants whatever it can't have. And a lot of people that worked on the Conan show stay on the Conan show because it's a very happy place to work, and it's a really fun little privately run laboratory of comedy that has a serious lack of adult supervision. So a lot of people love working there and work there a long time. And when people do leave the Conan show, I've seen sort of the clamor to get them from television networks or television studios. It has a cachet within the industry. So I just knew there'd be something for me. It wasn't the first couple of years I was worried about. It was the third year. I mean, if I had gone through the development process and nothing happened, and I would, you know, because I like, if this show doesn't go, I feel like, well, I could probably still get another development deal out of somebody. It's just the way the business works. There's plenty of people here in Los Angeles who have been making money for years just not working for somebody else. Somebody pays them to not work for somebody else. And they, you know, you can stretch that out for a few years.
Right. Andy Richter is my guest. He's formerly Conan O'Brien's sidekick on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Now he has his own show called Andy Richter Controls the Universe. When you were growing up, in addition to watching, like, network TV, were there, like, bizarre local shows that you used to watch because they were so weird or so amateurish?
Yeah, in Chicago there was a guy, there's a station in Chicago called WGN,
which is owned by the Chicago Tribune, and it's been around forever. And it's kind of was a precursor of the Superstation. It was on early cable systems around the country. And they carry Chicago Cubs games, and then also lots of strange kids shows, like they have a Bozo the Clown show. Ray Rayner was a children's host who basically was just a grown man who would wear orange jumpsuits and show cartoons and feed a goose, and then at times just put on marching music and march around the set with the goose. And that would take up an hour every morning. And I don't think at the time, you know, as a child, I didn't think of it as odd. it was just television.
Now, you studied improv for a while. You worked, I think, with Del Close in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's not a very familiar name. Tell us about him.
Well, he's one of the. He's heavily influential because he taught a lot of people that are responsible for sort of the modern state of sketch comedy, I guess. He was one of the first people that was with the Compass, a group in Chicago that was the precursor of Second City. And he pretty much invented long-form improvisation, which is what most of the groups in Chicago sort of specialize in, especially the Improv Olympic, which is what his group was. But he taught people like Bill Murray and John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and Mike Myers and people, you know, and Chris Farley, and, you know, just taught many, many people how to be funny and an artistic way to be funny and a set of rules that that if you follow them, you'd be hard pressed to do bad work if you follow the rules that he teaches you. And he passed away a few years ago, but he's tremendously. I mean, I wouldn't hesitate to say there would not be a Saturday Night Live, which, you know, good or bad, whatever your opinion of that show, it's a pretty important part of the comedy landscape, and in just in a historical sense, it wouldn't be there if it weren't for Del Close.
What were some of Del Close's rules for improvisation?
Well, they're agreement. It's treating comedy different from drama, and that sort of the fuel of drama is conflict. But if you're improvising a scene, it doesn't work to have conflict. It just sort of stops. It's more about the flow of something. So if someone comes into a scene and says, "Doctor, my back is killing me," you don't say, "I'm not a doctor, I'm an umbrella salesman," because you might get a laugh, but then where do you go? You've made the other person look like an idiot, and that's it. The scene is over. But if you say, you know, "Well, in order to get in order to fix your back, you have to get on this snowmobile," you know, then you've started something. They call it yes and. You agree and add to it. And then there's also different. One of the rules that it mirrors an acting rule, which is that the actor is a slave to the text, that the actual performance piece is more important than the actor himself. It's the same. There's a rule in improv, which is no one player is more important than the group. So it's trying to create a group mind, and it's downplaying selfishness.
Now, you had a small part in the Chris Elliott movie Cabin Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand when that movie came out, you were actually working in a movie theater in Los Angeles as an assistant manager.
I had run out of money and was starting to apply for jobs. And the day that I got hired on the Conan show, I got called back to re-interview. You know, I got called a call back as an actor. I got, you know, they wanted to come and interview me for this job as an assistant manager, which I was deathly afraid of Cabin Boy coming out and me being behind the counter making popcorn when it came out, and people thinking it was some kind of publicity stunt.
And it would just be the sad truth.
It would just be sad, pathetic truth.
So, you know, you've done all comedies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on TV, comedy roles in movies, comedy with Conan O'Brien. Do you have the ambition of, like, doing drama, whether it's, like, you know, playing the hard-boiled detective or having your shot at Macbeth?
The hard-boiled detective more than Macbeth. Macbeth is way too much memorization. I would be fun. I just want to work. I really love being in this business, and I feel tremendously lucky because I feel like I've found the vocation for which I am suited, and I want to work at it for a long, long time. I said when I left the Conan show and people were comparing me to David Caruso, who left NYPD Blue and then his career faltered, I said, you know, I'm not trying to be Warren Beatty. I'm trying to be Ned Beatty. So I think I can pull that off. I hope, you know, and I would be very happy to because I think he's a, you know, Ned Beatty's a tremendously talented man, you know.
Well, Andy Richter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Andy Richter's new Fox sitcom is called Andy Richter Controls the Universe. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by drummer Ed Thigpen featuring saxophonist Joe Lovano. This is Fresh Air. In the 1950s and 60s, drummer Ed Thigpen toured with pianist Oscar Peterson and with Ella Fitzgerald and made records with diverse musicians, from John Coltrane to harpist Dorothy Ashby. In 1972, he moved to Copenhagen. From there, he's worked with many European musicians and fellow expatriates like Dexter Gordon, Johnny Griffin, and Thad Jones. In the 90s, Thigpen hooked up with younger American musicians like bassist John Lindbergh and put together his own Danish trio. On Thigpen's new CD, he puts them together with a visitor from New York, saxophonist Joe Lovano. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it was worth the trip.
A jazz drummer is a bit like the Western bad guy who shoots at strangers' feet to make them dance. Both aim to get folks moving with precision firepower. Drummers tend to have more benign motives and generally show off less than gunslinging bullies, although there are exceptions like Buddy Rich. Ed Thigpen gets the job done quietly, shoring up a tune's beat or coaxing soloists along with sympathetic comments or a snipe at the heels. But he also knows when to leave a soloist be and let the story unfold without kibitzing. Ed Thigpen is the son of a jazz drummer, and tenor player Joe Lovano is the son of a jazz saxophonist. They had the music in their ears from infancy. Lovano and pianist Karsten Dahl have also played drums from childhood, which enhances the quartet's cracked timing. Bassist Jesper Bodilsen keeps up too. Joe Lovano is a strong and consistent player, but he sounds especially good here. One showcase is Billy Strayhorn's ballad Chelsea Bridge, where Lovano fine-tunes his tone quality the way Thigpen keeps refining his brushwork. Ed Thigpen's new CD, recorded live in Copenhagen, is The Element of Swing on the Stunt label. True to the title, every piece deals with swing time from a slightly different angle or tempo. Swing isn't everything in jazz, but it's always been a quick shortcut to the pleasure receptors and has a happy effect on soloists lucky enough to catch a wave. Lately, Joe Lovano's own records have been concept-driven, tributes to Sinatra and Caruso and such, which can rein him in a bit. Freed of the responsibilities of leadership, he makes the most of his working vacation, and the locals get to watch the stranger dance.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Ed Thigpen's new CD, The Element of Swing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Harcourt, publisher of The Middle of Everywhere, The World's Refugees Come to Our Town, Stories from the Frontline of Refugee Life in America by Mary Pfeiffer. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oregon's law legalizing physician-assisted suicide has been challenged by Attorney General John Ashcroft. An injunction is keeping the law in effect until a federal judge issues his ruling. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from an oncologist in Oregon who has legally prescribed lethal doses of medication for terminally ill patients. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.